Good evening, everyone. This is Dr. Nalini Chilko. I am the founder of the American Institute of Integrative Oncology Research and Education, and this is our live Grand Rounds call for the Foundations of Integrative Oncology course. This call lasts approximately 1 hour. We'll start with a clinical pearl, then we move on to case studies and questions from you. Please be mindful of patient privacy when you ask questions or present cases to ensure that all discussions are completely confidential and patient identifying information is redacted on all records and in your comments. For reference, you are currently muted, but feel free to press *7 to unmute yourself and you can chime in and ask a question and or make a comment. I will pause and give times and breaks to do that. So let's get started by going into our clinical pearl. Now tonight, I want to speak about Honokiol, H-O-N-O-K-I-O-L. This is a phytochemical that is found in magnolia bark, and the research has been done on Chinese magnolia bark, and in fact, this herbal medicine has been used in traditional Chinese medicine for over 2,000 years. It's called Hupo, H-O-U-P-O, if you're a Chinese speaker, forgive me for the pronunciation. And it has been used in traditionally for thousands of years to treat a variety of gastrointestinal disorders, neurological diseases, because it crosses the blood-brain barrier. It's been used in anxiety in modern times and also in China for seizures. It's one of my absolutely favorite phytochemicals in the oncology setting. In traditional use, it is described as being bitter, acrid, warm, and aromatic. And if you're a student of Chinese medicine, you know that we describe things in this way. And it has several active ingredients. There are some bisphenols called magnolol and honokiol. And we're going to speak about honokiol tonight. And then it has a triterpene in it called eudesmol, and that gives it its fragrance. And if you are not a student of botany, you should know that plants that have triterpenes are fragrant. They usually have aromatic oils. So think about mint and sage, for example. Now, the beautiful thing about honokiol is it has a really wide margin of safety. It doesn't really have any toxic side effects. It's usually extremely well tolerated. And depending on how much you're giving your patient, my experience is that some patients get diarrhea from it. And if that happens, I just have them take smaller, more frequent doses so that they can tolerate it in their GI tract. Or I will have them take it with some warming digestive herbs like ginger or cinnamon or black pepper, for example, or in some, you know, chai tea, spicy chai tea that doesn't have any black tea or caffeine in it. So warming up the stomach and the digestive tract with warm hot tea, hot water, and these warming herbs often mitigates the GI side effects, and also to have patients take it with food in their stomach. Now, you can get this isolate, purified honokiol, as a 98% pure powder from certain suppliers. I actually purchase honokiol in capsules from Clinical Synergy is the professional line manufactured by Dr. Isaac Elias, E-L-I-A-Z, and the slides I have tonight are the courtesy of Dr. Elias. And he makes an encapsulated product of honokiol called Pure Honokiol. He also has a retail line called Eco-Nugenics, and on that line, the product is called Hono Pure, H-O-N-O-P-U-R-E. They're an identical product, but he protects clinicians with the Clinical Synergy line to have your patients, you know, check in with you for management. And I like to have it available as a capsule because it's really bitter. And so bitter herbs, patients tend not to be very compliant at all. There's also a traditional Chinese formula that I use a lot. It's called Pinellia and Magnolia formula. It's a classic traditional formula that's been around for a long time, and its main ingredients are Pinellia or Banxia, B-A-N-X-I-A, and Hupo, Magnolia. And I use it for mostly stagnation, obstruction, congestion in the GI tract, particularly the upper GI tract, the stomach, and the small intestine. And so it's really a formula that's for what we call stagnation in Chinese medicine. And Chinese medicine looks at cancer as an obstruction of the smooth flow of the qi and blood and of dampness. So it's about congestion. So Pinellia Magnolia formula is a really nice balanced formula. And so a way to think about using whole herbs and herbal formulas, you can use that to get all of the phytochemicals and a more support for digestive function in a traditional formula. And then you could use the isolate phytochemical of the purified Hinokio on top of that to get a pharmacologic dose. And that's a nice way to think about it. So the properties of Hinokio are many. It has anti-inflammatory activity. It also has antioxidant activity. It also is a very mild antimicrobial. But the reason I love it in oncology is because it has the ability to restore normal apoptosis. So it has an impact on the mitochondria. And it also will influence cell cycling and induce cell cycle arrest, so it can inhibit replication of tumor cells. It also inhibits angiogenesis, so if we have someone with metastatic cancer, stage 3 or 4 cancer, then we can think of using it. But it's there's a lot of research on breast cancer and Hinokio, and I've given you a wealth of references in the study guide for Hinokio if you want to take a deeper dive into this. And then in modern times, Hinokio and Magnolia have been used frequently for helping people to relax and go to sleep. It's not a true sedative, but it's a bit, some people, it depends on the patient, some people get sleepy when they take it in the daytime. And so if that happens, remember we all metabolize drugs products differently, then in that case, excuse me, I have to turn off my phone. In that case, I have the patient take their doses at dinner and bedtime, and I'll often dose it. Most of the capsules are 250 milligram capsules. So I'll often have patients take 1500 milligrams a day. So I'll give 2 capsules 3 times a day with the last dose at bedtime. But if they are feeling sedated from the Hinokio, you could give 3 at dinner and 3 at near bedtime so that it could have a little something in their stomach if it bothers their stomach. So it's nice because cancer patients tend to be anxious anyway. The Hinokio does cross the blood-brain barrier, and so it brings its actions and some neuroprotection into the central nervous system. And that's meaningful because most cancer patients have a leaky blood-brain barrier, and the physiology of cancer itself contributes to that, and also the treatments contribute to a leaky blood-brain barrier in the same way that you can get a leaky barrier in your gut. So the fact that it's leaky means that the Magnolol and Hinokio would get in there too. It has some synergistic effects with some chemotherapy agents. I don't really use it that way because it does upset the digestion. So I usually give it concurrently with chemo. It does have some impact on metastasis because it's slowing down metastasis because it impairs angiogenesis. And again, just, you know, it's not toxic. The digestive symptoms are because it is really bitter. And so bitter herbs tend to take away digestive fire. And so that's why you want to add something warming like ginger or cinnamon to it and give it with hot water or soup or something like that. And that's the art of herbal medicine, is to take a medicine that has a gift and then make it work in the system. And so traditional herbal medicine never uses anything by itself, but any one single herb by itself typically. But in this context, in the way that I teach, we're also using things pharmacologically to try and get these super high doses. And so then you need to think about if the digestive tract needs some support, for example. Now, the primary mechanisms of action are many. It will block signaling in tumors that have P53 mutations. So if you are reading a pathology report and you see that somebody has a P53 mutation in their tumor, that means that they cannot really perform apoptosis properly. And so this is something you might want to add then to their protocol. It also will potentiate the normal functioning of the mitochondria. And this is very important because it's the mitochondria that initiate apoptosis. And so we want to support that. And then one of its great powerful activities is it blocks NF-kappa-B, nuclear factor kappa-B. So it is also significantly anti-inflammatory, because being a nuclear factor, NF-kappa-B is far upstream. And so if you can inhibit the expression of that, then you also inhibit the expression of downstream pro-inflammatory molecules like COX-1 and 2 and the prostaglandins and LOX-5, things like that. So very powerful in blocking inflammation. And one of the most powerful things it does, it inhibits something called mTOR, little m, capital T, capital O, capital R. And mTOR is part of the PI3K-AKT pathway that leads to influencing PTEN, P-T-E-N, which is a tumor suppressor gene. So by influencing this pathway, you might read a tumor pathology report that says PTEN is not expressed. And so that means that you have oncogenes that are active, and PTEN can then be activated by taking Hinokiol. And so this is very important to improve tumor suppression. Being an antioxidant, it also quenches some reactive oxygen species and so reduces oxidative stress. And the reason it's anti-anxiety is that it will modulate the GABA receptors in the brain. And that's the GABA pathway is how drugs like Xanax and Valium work. The benzodiazepines work through the GABA pathway. And so if you have a patient who's anxious, you can think about using Hinokiol with them. L-theanine also is a nice mild anti-anxiety nutraceutical that also works through this GABA pathway. It's not as sedative as the Hinokiol is. So when we use this, again, let's just go back over the dosing for active cancer control support. So I use it if somebody is in treatment for cancer. I use it in patients who are living with cancer as a chronic illness. I use it in people who have had successful treatment of their cancer, and we want to keep oncogenes turned off and tumor suppressor genes turned on. So you can use it at every phase of the journey. Because it is not toxic, you can use it long term. And so two capsules, is each capsule 250 milligrams, would be given two caps, 500 milligrams, three times a day. Can start there. And that's the typical dose that I give. I would start at a lower dose and just see how someone tolerates it in their GI tract. So you could start with one, three times a day. If they tolerate that, you can stair step it up and remind the patient when you prescribe it to take it with something warming, or just with a meal is fine. You can also think about if a patient's pretty low risk, they could probably be maintained on 1 gram a day. So that'd be 2 caps twice a day. That would be adequate for very low risk patients. If you want to use it for inflammation control, then you can similarly dose it. Think that you're also providing antioxidant support at these maintenance doses. And sometimes you can just, someone who gets anxious or can't unwind in the evening, you can just give it to them before bed, like 250 to 500 milligrams before bed, perhaps with a little magnesium and a little melatonin, and help them to sleep that way. I give a small dose of melatonin for that purpose. Remember, we use melatonin in high doses for its impact on cancer cells. So you might be giving 10 milligrams or up to 20 milligrams of melatonin at the same time. But melatonin is not a sedative. It's a dark signal to the brain. And so it, the more you give, it is more sedating typically. So to summarize, really has a broad activity in terms of its anti-tumor functions. It is extremely low toxicity. It's very bioavailable. It does cross the blood-brain barrier. It has antioxidant, immune-modulating, anti-inflammatory, neuroprotective, anti-anxiety, and mild antimicrobial impact. It does promote tumor suppression via the PI3K, AKT, mTOR, P10 pathway. It also acts through the GABA pathway. So you can think of it maybe combined with adaptogens also for someone who has ongoing stress. And it is a potent suppressor of oxidative damage. And so that is an overview of Hinokiol, which is something I really, really like to use in with patients as part of a larger protocol. So I will stop here, and if anyone wants to unmute themselves and ask a question, I'll take a breath and allow you to do so. That would be *7. Okay. So I'm going to move on. We didn't have any cases submitted this time. I think it's because it's just the holidays and there's a lot going on for everybody. But there are a couple of questions. But since we did not have a case, I want to teach one more thing and bring to your attention a recently published paper by Thomas Seyfried, who is well known for putting forth the idea that cancer is actually a metabolic and mitochondrial syndrome, and that the ketogenic diet is one of the most powerful ways to control cancer proliferation. And so he just published a paper in 2017, which is entitled Press Pulse, a Novel Therapeutic Strategy for the Metabolic Management of Cancer. And in the journal Nutrition and Metabolism, and you'll have this reference in your notes. So here's the high altitude idea, and I really just want to bring this paper to your attention. It's not a long paper, and it's very well written, but this is the idea behind it. He looks at the way nature solves problems, which is something I love about him, and he looks at metabolism and how we can alter it, not with drugs necessarily, but by lifestyle changes such as diet. So he put forth this paper to look at the fact that there are stressors in nature that could be ongoing stressors, and then in nature there can also be events that happen infrequently and randomly. So the press part of this idea is that there is pressure on the organism over a long period of time. So say that might be an ice age, something like that, something that happens for a long period of time, or a drought, something like that. Or in a diabetic, might be hyperglycemia. It's an ongoing problem. Then the pulse is the fact that events can happen. And so on top of, say, in a diabetic, then that diabetic might be in an auto accident and all of a sudden have really high cortisol and be going into surgery, etc. So this is the idea that there are ongoing stressors and then there are episodic stressors. And then how do organisms solve problems? How do they learn to survive? And conversely, what causes them not to survive? And so I think that this is interesting in the context of how chemotherapy is used as well, because it's kind of a pulsed type of a therapy. So if we are providing therapies and support from our integrative oncology viewpoint, if we are providing pressure on the cancer cells by creating an environment that is inhospitable to tumor cells, by withdrawing the conditions they need, such as a high glycemic load and high insulin, then the tumor cells will suffer. They will not thrive. And so this is the idea of the ketogenic diet, is to have insulin and glucose be very low and provide this environment that is not good for cancer cells, because you withhold their energy source, and eat a diet that has the production of ketones, which we can use for energy as humans. And so this is the idea of creating an environment by using a ketogenic diet that creates an ongoing pressure on the tumor cells. Then he suggests that hyperbaric oxygen therapy be the pulse, and that by combining these two therapies, you can stress tumor cells and thereby cause some, exert more control over the behavior of tumor cells and even have cytotoxic effects. So think about what we do. If we are using our botanical, nutraceutical, and dietary and lifestyle protocols to create an environment where cancer cannot thrive, where carcinogenesis, tumorigenesis, proliferation, and progression and metastasis are hampered because we create an environment that's not supportive of that. And then we can also think about what kind of pulse therapies could we do in that context. So it might be then that IV vitamin C could be used for a period of time or in a pulsed way to create a pro-oxidative stress to the tumor cells that would be cytotoxic. So I think this is a really interesting paper and very, very much worth reading. And so he also presents the idea that before a pulse, you could create more stress by restricting calories on those days. And so we know that intermittent fasting is also stressful to tumor cells. And so these are the main ideas in this paper. It fits beautifully into, you know, the paradigm and the framework that I use and I am teaching you. So let me just take a breath there and allow anyone who wishes to comment or ask a question to do so. Okay. So there are a couple of questions from Judy, who is like, she's so on it. Judy, you're so engaged and so you ask great questions. So I'm going to go through your questions one by one, and I first want to start by saying that the questions that Judy has posed have a lot to do with dosing and administering herbs and nutraceuticals and phytochemicals, and some confusion and the need for clarification around things. And so it brings to my attention that we might actually need a bonus lecture on posology, or the art of dosing and deciding not only what the dose is, but what the frequency of the dose is. So I'm going to think about that and either create a little mini lecture or a handout for you to clarify this, because when you are not accustomed to using botanicals at all, or if you are a seasoned herbalist but you're not accustomed to using isolates in combination with botanicals, I can see where the confusion is. So let me charge ahead and read through Judy's first question. She says, you indicated that the white blood cell count of 6.2 was good enough. Let me stop there and say, if you have a patient on a treatment that is myelosuppressive, that is causing some myeloablation and dysfunction in the ability of the bone marrow to produce cells, then we watch that white blood cell count. And actually, if the white blood cell count is 2.5 or above, then the patient has adequate immunity to respond to an infection. If it goes below that, the patient is very, very at risk. And if the white blood cell count goes below 2.5, I do not acupuncture them because I don't want to do anything that would risk infection in an extremely frail and vulnerable person in terms of their ability to mount a response to infection. I might use magnets on their points. I might use acupressure on their points, but I don't pierce the skin. So your question really is about calculating. So let me clarify what, so I just clarified your question about what constitutes the high risk of infection. It's just looking at the white blood cell count, the WBC. That's our benchmark there. But we also use the absolute neutrophil count, which is different. It's another count. And then you also asked about the neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio. So let me first say that the absolute neutrophil count simply reflects the number of neutrophils, period. And it is a mirror to what's happening in the bone marrow. So that's what it reflects. And so you can either watch the white blood cell count or the absolute neutrophil count, but it's more common in clinical practice to use the 2.5 cutoff point. That's what is used in oncology centers, but also watching what's happening to the neutrophils. The neutrophil lymphocyte ratio is not a measure of risk of infection. It's not a direct measure of that. So that's, I think, maybe where some confusion is. The neutrophil lymphocyte ratio is calculated by taking the number of neutrophils and dividing that number by the number of lymphocytes. So if you had, I'll just use simple math, if you had 4 neutrophils and 1 lymphocyte, your neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio would be 4. And so that's how you calculate that. And that is a reflection of the ability of the immune system to mount a response to tumor cells, okay? Not just infection, but to tumor cells. And so that's the difference. So let me stop there and say, Judy, did I answer that question clearly for you? You can unmute yourself. I see
you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah. Hi, did I clarify?
Yeah, the NL ratio was great. I didn't realize it was in reference to the tumor cells and not infection in general. And so then the ANC, we just keep our eye on it, but it's not necessarily going to influence how much infection we're concerned about for that person.
Well, it does, but we want to be, if we're going to have a seat at the table in an integrative oncology team, we should know what the conventions are that oncologists use.
Okay.
Right? So when you see an absolute neutrophil count that's bottoming out, you have myeloablation, not just myelosuppression. So, for example, I had a patient recently, I have a patient, and she went through super aggressive chemotherapy, and her absolute neutrophil count and her white blood cells were so low that she had to have Neulasta or Neupogen, whatever her doctor was using, I don't remember, every single week and sometimes twice a week. And she actually ended up being hospitalized and on IV antibiotics. And so she was getting towards the end of her course of chemotherapy. And I just finally said, stop. I just said, stop. If this patient is going to live, then she has to have some bone marrow left to go on with her life. And we can't just ablate it. And so, we talked to the oncologist, I explained this to the patient, and I talked to the oncologist who agreed that we could stop. And so, you know, that's a judgment call. And, we just did a scan and she had nothing on her scan. So she didn't really need more chemo, right? So this is when we are more, often spend more time with the patient, see how they're suffering more than the doctor does. And so that was, I finally just said, no more. We just can't do this. You know, what's the benefit? So that's a risk versus benefit assessment of how much more benefit are we going to get out of doing two more chemos, about what's the risk to the patient of doing that. So I felt that there was more risk than benefit at this point in a very long treatment course. And so I made that statement by the bottoming out of the absolute neutrophil count. And as you know, Judy, we have herbs that can help support the restoration of the bone marrow. And we also have stomach 36 as an acupuncture point that does that. And then we can do our blood nourishing points and know that large intestine 4 also improves white cell count. So stomach 36 actually improves both natural killer cells as well as red blood cells. So and doing moxa is very powerful. So I often teach the patient to do that at home. So anything else you want to respond to or say or ask?
No, that was great. I would love to go back to the last case that you brought up, or when you brought up the study with Thomas, whatever his last name is. Were there other pulsings that he talked about besides the vitamin C?
I actually put vitamin C as an example, but we've uploaded the paper for you to read. In this context, I just wanted to bring the paper to your attention and the big ideas in it, so that when you sit down to read it, you have a frame of reference. And I don't actually have the paper in front of me at this moment. But mostly he was using an example of ketogenic diet with hyperbaric oxygen. That was sort of his example in the paper. But we, with our toolbox, could think of other ways to do that. So I was giving an example of vitamin C as a way to do it. Okay? All right. So now I'm going to go on to the rest of your questions. So next question is, you indicated that vitamin E is shown to interfere with the action of EGCG for follicular lymphoma, and that the nutritional dietary dose is okay, but not supplementing. Most multivitamin mineral formulas do have vitamin E in them at levels that are not the normal minimum daily requirement, the normal dosing, and would I recommend not taking a multi? So great question. So I would say a multi that has no more than 400 units is probably fine. That's a pretty small dose of vitamin E as things go. And so I don't think that would be harmful. And then that would mean we could still use multivitamins. So I think that that's a good barometer of that. Then you ask a question about dosing vitamin A. So you recommend dosing vitamin A at two different levels, 5,000 to 10,000 units three times a week. But then later I said 10,000 units a day. You also note that you would be monitoring serum vitamin A levels, which I would recommend if we're using vitamin A long-term and dosing it like that. Would I suggest every 2 months is appropriate, or do I have a source of vitamin A that I prefer? Okay. So, first of all, let's clarify. We're not talking about beta carotene. We're talking about vitamin A. Okay. And secondly, let me clarify. If we are dealing with cancers that are linked to viral events and viral triggers, then we think about using things that are antiviral as part of the long-term maintenance and concurrently during treatment. So it really depends a lot on the patient. So I would recommend using 5,000 if we're going to do it ongoing for a long period of time, because remember, vitamin A is stored, right? So I think, you know, I would, after the first month of that, I would check at 4 weeks, 3-4 weeks, see, because we don't know how different patients metabolize, utilize, or store vitamins, and you can get some toxicity out of vitamin A, although I have never seen that, but it's in the literature. So I always think it's better to be conservative and start slow and monitor how the patient does. And then if you had been Using vitamin A at 5,000 units 3 times a week for a long period of time, then you could probably feel quite confident in checking every 8 to 10 or 12 weeks, but to monitor it. You would not want to go really high doses of vitamin A with somebody who had liver disease or liver impairment, because that's where vitamin A is stored, and the literature states that high levels of vitamin A, when a patient has toxicity, it affects their liver. But again, I have never seen that. To clarify, I think using 10,000 units can be appropriate, but that's more high risk. So if you don't have experience using vitamin A, just get to 5,000, and then if we have a patient who's younger, more robust, has a really healthy liver, we could look at it. But dosing guidelines are often based on serum levels, not, you know, so it's connected to that patient in an individualized way. I know you're going to ask me, Judy, you're going to ask me what serum level should we look for, and I have to look that up. I don't know off the top of my head. Now, I do use 10,000 units a day short term in patients with acute viral infections. And so if somebody has a cold or a flu or a herpes outbreak, for example, or Epstein-Barr, something like that, then I'll give them 10,000 units a day for 5 to 10 days, and it really accelerates the resolution of an acute viral infection. And then I might give them, if they're at risk and vulnerable because they're frail or immune suppressed, I might give them 5,000 3 times a week for a while. So I think with those guidelines, you would be safe. So I think that can guide you. And I like to use Vital Nutrients as one of my favorite companies. They have vitamin A in 10,000 and 25,000 capsules. And I think Pure Encapsulations also has vitamin A in those doses. Pure Encapsulations was just sold to a big corporation, and I'm always wary when that happens. Sometimes the quality control goes down the tube, so we'll have to watch. But Vital Nutrients, actually know the owners. They're a small company, and they're very meticulous. So I like their products very much. They also have acetyl L-carnitine in powder form, and I'll put that in people's shakes. And acetyl L-carnitine is for neuron repair and chemo brain, cognitive impairment from cancer and cancer-related treatments. So I like the Vital Nutrients company quite a lot. They have a berberine capsule in 500 milligrams. They have melatonin in 10 and 20 milligrams, I think. And what else do I use from them? They have a nice Feverfew capsule as well that I use for migraine patients. I really, really, really like that company. So, although I love Designs for Health, they don't carry everything. So, I really vet companies. I actually talk to the owners, et cetera. And I do know some of the principals at Pure Encapsulations, but they're a gigantic company. And I think they have a handful of products that are unique, but I'm going to be watching them starting now to see what happens to their quality control. All right. So then you have another question that's really about how to dose things, how to think about. So when looking at your dosing recommendations for certain botanicals, you sometimes list them separately in grams per day, and at other times they're found in an herbal formula. I understand the reason for single versus formulaic dosing. Is there a way of converting? Okay. So let me first answer that. So this is really about what's the difference between using something by itself, like Ganoderma, which is not a phytochemical. It's, a Chinese medicinal mushroom. So we're not pulling an isolate out of it. We're not pulling the ganodermic acid out of it. We're using a properly prepared powder usually. And so this would be the pharmacologic use of something in our materia medica, or like we just spoke about Hinokiol, using it pharmacologically. So we talked about Hinokiol being able to be used at 1500 milligrams a day to exert some influence on these biochemical pathways within the cell. But I also spoke about Pinellia and Magnolia formula that doesn't have Hinokiol in it. It has Magnolia bark in it. So that's a significant difference. To differentiate an isolate, which is something that is extracted in a laboratory, versus the whole plant. And I think, so 3 grams of Magnolia bark is not the same as 3 grams of Hinokiol. So that's important to understand. And I fall somewhere in the middle because of whether one should use whole herbs or isolates, and I think we should use both. I think that when we use whole herbs, and traditionally whole herbs are used in the context of a formula, that we get a lot of the micronutrients and the whole range of phytochemicals that are in a plant. We really don't know enough to say, oh, we should just pull Hinokiol out. That's allopathic medicine, really, is to just pull one thing out and only use that and not, you know, appreciate the elegance of nature. And we simply don't know enough. And these plants that have been used as whole plant medicine for thousands of years, we need to respect and learn from that tradition. We, of course, would like to analyze it chemically. But if you took Pinellia and Magnolia formula, or you just took Magnolia bark tea, an infusion of Magnolia bark, you would have a small amount of Hinokiol in there. So if we want to use a pharmacologic dose, then you have the choice to use a formula, which is nice and balanced, and put the Hinokiol powder in there, but in this case, it would make it super bitter. On the other hand, let's say you were using a formula like astragalus and ganoderma formula, which is a lovely immune modulating formula that's very, very balanced, but you wanted the patient to get a big dose of ganoderma also, then you could mix the ganoderma into that because it wouldn't taste bad, right? So that's part of the deciding factor of how you administer that. So I think if you wanted to give 3 grams of ganoderma a day, you can just throw it in a shake if your patient is taking a shake. That's an easy way for them to have less pills. But if you're mixing freeze-dried formulas, for example, you could mix it with the ganoderma in there. So that's a viable way. But it's really the difference between using whole herbs. We can't say we're giving 3 grams of something if we are using a whole plant. In this case, we are using the whole medicinal mushroom, but with things that are not medicinal mushrooms, then we're extracting out these active principles. So when I write formulas for my patients that I've presented, my plans for patients in some of the case studies, then I am using milliliters because I mix liquids. And, you know, you could translate those proportions into milligrams and grams, certainly, to understand proportions. But I am looking at using the whole plant, and then sometimes I will then add extra something to create a pharmacologic impact on a particular pathway or function. Let me ask you if that answered the question. Judy, did that answer the question? There you are.
Here we go. Okay. So yes, and a question, because I've been sleuthing around who I would get different custom formulas from, and two questions. One is, I like to keep life simple, so I'd like to find a company that I can perhaps get most, and I can from Suntan, but Rhabdoxia, Gotu Cola, and Feverfew, they don't carry. So do you know of a company?
I use Golden Lotus outside of Ashland.
They haven't gotten back to me, but I'll try. So, I'll stay with them.
Oh, ask for Dave. Just ask to talk to Dave.
Okay,
tell him I sent you. I think that Con Herbs does some formulating. But they don't have the Western herbs. They only have the Chinese herbs. You know, I mix things up. So they don't have some of the Ayurvedic herbs. So I've just been using Golden Lotus for so long, but they don't mix the formulas for me. I have a big pharmacy, compounding pharmacy in my clinic. I mix them myself. But you could talk to Dave. He used to do that for me, but I don't think he's really set up. But you could think about if there were some kind of base formulas you wanted mixed, and then you could modify them and have, you know, a couple bottles in your, have a big bottle of the, you know, base formula, and then be able to modify it. You could, might think about doing that. Like,
yeah,
you could
doing caps with Sun-10 and then just doing the liquids on my own by getting the three individual
tinctures. Oh, you've got powders too. You can also buy the powders from Evergreen, John Chen's company.
Yeah, they're limited also on what they have. But I guess you're answering the question. You just have to go to a lot of different companies.
Yeah, sometimes you do. Oh, there's this great company in Arizona that has a lot of herbs, like some herbs that I can never get. I'm not thinking of the name, but I will think of it. That's in Arizona. That they get me things like Camp Dothica, which is a rarely used herb. And they have it. And they're really meticulous about their quality. And, and the other thing is, because I've just been using Golden Lotus for so long, the other thing is to maybe call up to or ask someone who is part of one of the naturopathic schools of where they get their herbs for their clinic and see who they're using.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for your questions.
You bet.
All right. So that brings us to the end of my clinical pearl, the recent published article, and the questions that were presented for this call. We have 10 minutes if anyone wants to ask any questions that are related or unrelated. I'd be happy to answer them. I also just want to say that we are, in response to the amazing people who are in this course, is we want to create a forum and a way for you all to interact with each other and a place where questions can be put not only in front of me, but in front of the group. And so we're looking at platforms for that purpose. And then a number of people in the course have also asked about a certification program and CEUs, and we're working on that. It's a rather big project. So we are getting close to having that. And then once we have that, we can apply for CEUs, and we'll do so. I'm certain that we'll have CEUs for California acupuncturists, and I'm going to apply to the American Holistic Nurses Association for CEUs for nurses, and Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine may also certify my course for CEUs for naturopaths. So we're working on it. It's a time-consuming process, but we really, really listen to the things you ask us for and that are important to you. And this course has been live for less than 1 year right now, and the response has been incredible, and it's so meaningful and exciting and fulfilling for me. And when I get your case studies and I see that you're actually using this, it's really my main motivation is to pass this on and be able to have clinicians who feel confident and touch more people. So that's sort of an update of where we are and the things we're working on. And we're going to build up a library, and I'm also working on more modules. So that is sort of a wrap up of where we're working on, my team, my wonderful team. So I'll just pause again and ask if anyone wants to comment or ask any other questions about anything. We have a little time.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, this is Sarah.
So hi, Sarah.
I had sent in a question, but I don't know, maybe didn't.
It didn't get on here?
So anyway, because we have time, I'll bring it up.
Yeah,
I have about a 70-year-old man with intraductal pancreatic mucinous neoplasm, or IPMN.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I mean, it's just been diagnosed, and he actually underwent a Whipple.
Yeah.
What is something that I can advise him or, you know, look out for or support him in any way? I don't have many details right now. Yeah.
So one of the questions I would ask is, you know, was there metastatic disease or not?
No, there isn't.
So he could be relatively cancer free right now. You know,
yes.
Was it a very big mass? Do you know if it was a very big
mass? No, it was not.
Okay.
They told him that it was all out, and so he had taken it all out. Yeah.
So let's just say it could be any cancer for the next comment I'm going to make.
Okay.
So I look at the size of a mass, and because that tells us if it's possible that there was metastasis, micro metastasis. I think we always have to think about that, because a mass that's only 3 millimeters has a billion cells in it. So the likelihood that there's some microscopic disease is there, and we don't have it for circulating tumor cells for pancreas. But I will tell you that BioCept Lab is doing tests on these cancers for data gathering, and you can contact them and run it. And they're in San Diego, BioCept. They're a very wonderful company. And so these are not FDA approved for other cancers, only 3 cancers that are approved, prostate, breast, and colorectal. But they're doing other studies. So that would be interesting to do. And then what you want to think about then is, even if it's a small mass, I assume there's some micrometastases, right? I just assume there is as a fail-safe. And so, and we could think maybe there's some cancer stem cells running around as well. So we want to think about what would we do for micro level of disease. And then also, what in this case would be particular to pancreatic cancer cells, one of the very best things for pancreatic is thymoquinone. And the best source of that is Nigella sativa oil, black cumin seed oil.
Right,
and
yeah.
So I really like to put that in a pancreatic cancer protocol. Think about someone who just lost a large portion of their digestive tract. So the first thing, before you can give anything, you have to, rebuild their digestion.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So in a Whipple, so for people who don't know what a Whipple is, the pancreas and part of the small intestine is removed. And so you lose a lot of your digestive and absorptive function. And so it's really important, if we're going to rely on a nutrient-dense diet, if we're going to rely on nutraceuticals and botanicals, which are given orally, we need to know that the person will have the capacity to benefit from those things we recommend. So that would be your job right now, is to rebuild their digestive function. And and then go from there, you know, give that a little while, see how he's digesting. It's a tough surgery to recover from. So think about the stress of the surgery and how you would support him maybe with some adaptogens. And at this stage of the game, maybe something like a shake and a bone broth and, you know, that have Chinese herbs in them, so that he's getting nutrient density, but it's not too much work for his digestive tract. And with digestive enzymes, because we don't know what he's producing down there. So that you have to start there. And that's really in naturopathic medicine and in Chinese medicine, the school of thought is that you have to start with the digestive tract, no matter what, right? No matter what. And so, especially if you just removed part of it, right? But I have seen patients do really well after Whipples if they were caught early, and you can restore their digestion and provide them with nutrient density. I actually have a friend of mine who's been alive for, 25 years after a Whipple procedure.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, he was around 50 when she was diagnosed.
Goodness.
So, you know, if there's a health model, then what happens to these patients is much better outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the meantime, you can think about what are things maybe you could put in the food or the soup or the shake that are easy to digest, like the medicinal mushrooms, for example,
mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
astragalus, that would give him more immune robustness.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Things like that. And you just have to see how they do. How old is this person?
He's about 70.
Yeah.
So the astragalus is used as a supplement or as food?
No, it's not. It's not used as food, but it doesn't taste like anything. And so there's this tradition of medicinal soups in Chinese medicine. I think about the things that the taste would not make a problem, right? Wouldn't cause a problem people liking to drink it or not. And astragalus is like no taste. The medicinal mushrooms barely have any taste. So I'll put things like that in. In women's blood building soups, they put in dong quai, but that has a pretty strong taste. That's Angelica sinensis. Milk thistle doesn't have a very strong taste. So if you're not too familiar with herbs, knowing the taste is very important. And you could, if you're not really familiar with a lot of herbs, but you're curious, all of the Chinese materia medica, as well as the Ayurvedic, tell the taste of the herb. So if you see bitter or acrid, mm-hmm. it's not going to taste good. So, you know.
Yeah.
So you can think about it that way. Start to put in things at least that are adaptogens and immune modulators. And remember that some of the great tonic herbs, you can put ginseng in, it's a little bit bitter, so you just put a little bit in. And it's great for the digestion, you know, put ginger in to warm up the digestion. But the black cumin seed oil tastes like black cumin. And I often have people mix it with olive oil like a salad dressing, but we don't know what his fat digestion is like right now, so I'd wait and see about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
What were your thoughts? What were you going to do?
Well, I did the basic stuff that is outlined in your, you know, like the beginning of the lecture, so a good plant-based diet you know, adequate sleep and stress. And, so I was doing all those, you know, and of course the fish oil and the multivitamins and vitamin D. So, you know, so you do these things
the
and
basic.
It actually adds, adds up, you know, little by little, and he's already doing better. So that's good. And then maybe I could do some of these things that you just told me. Definitely
you know,
the nigella oil.
Yeah. You can try that. I would give lipase to him, you know, if you're using the fish oil.
Yeah.
Have him take it with the lipase. And Integrative Therapeutics makes a nice lipase product. And you could add medium-chain triglycerides because that would give him immediate calories.
Yes.
It doesn't require digestion. So.
The digestion, yeah.
So that's something to think about in a patient who is compromised in their ability to digest and absorb.
And and if I get his details, then I can present him.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So, everyone, thank you. We're hit the hour mark here. So I want to thank you for your participation. Remember, you can submit questions and case studies in advance. You log into the course, click on the Ground Rounds call page, and then you can see the directions for submitting. And I'll find out what happened to your question, Sarah, so we've problem solved that. And you really need to give me some lead time if you're going to present a case, because if I get a case, you know, a few days before the the call, I often won't have time to do it justice. So whomever wants to submit a case, give me a little lead time so I can do a good job for
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then, so our next call will be in a month from now. And if you need our support in navigating the course or you have feedback or suggestions, do let us know. Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Thank you.